Speaker today. Dr. Warner Woodworth is a man of many credentials. He received his PhD from the University of Michigan. He is currently on the faculty of the Marriott Graduate School of Business at Brigham Young University in consulting and other areas. He has 10 children. That is a credential. And for many years has been involved in issues and matters advocating things such as the precursor to the Perpetual Education Fund, one of the advocates for something of that nature, which finally came to fruition, deals with issues such as microcredit in disadvantaged areas, and has been a organizer or a member of several nonprofit organizations which each have a social action focus and basis. And so he's very in tune with the issues of social interaction with community and economy. And with that, I welcome Dr. Warner Woodworth.
Thanks. It's good to be here. It's hard to believe we're still at it, working and debating and struggling. I'm gonna use this overhead because I find that when the words disappear, maybe some of the visuals are still in one's mind, okay? So I hope that works. I don't know if it'll work, but we'll give it a try. My sort of theme, I guess, if we could start with a bit of a perspective. Several references in earlier sessions today and last night mentioned the disaster, the horrific events of 9/11, when roughly 3,000 people lost their lives. And I want to talk about the others that died that day. I want to talk about the 27,000 to 35,000 that also died on 9/11. And they're victims just as much as those who went down in the trade towers, World Trade Center. They're part of what we call the hyper poor, and they consist of about 1.5 billion people on this planet. Another 28,000 are dying today, May 3rd. And those in the hyper poor category, so to speak, are those who are dying because they can't get enough food and they haven't had nourishment, most of them, all their lives. Many, many, many of them are children. The majority of them are children. And they're not dying because of some terrible event today. They're dying because we aren't involved. We don't notice them. We notice the 9/11 victims. We don't notice these others. They're the unheralded ones. And so I kind of wanted to like I said, get a vision of some sort or other here. So I want to just sort of have them in our minds as a context for what I want to talk about and some of the pictures I want to show. Now, there's another group also roughly about the same numbers, 1.3, 1.4 billion, that are terribly poor. They're not in the hyper-poor. The hyper-poor are those trying to eke out on less than a dollar a day, less than a buck a day. How much did we spend today on ourselves? Our food, our conference, our hotel, our car. How many live today on less than $5? $10? 50? Come on, you students. I know you. Yeah, we're saying we're close to hyper poor. Yeah. So, and then this other 1.5 billion or so are extremely poor, but they're living on $2 a day on average. And then there's the rest of the world. So as we think about our situation, how am I going to get this thing working here right? Something like that, I guess, huh? You've got the cartoon. I wonder if God can really hear me. Hey, God, what should I do with my life? God responds, feed the hungry, right injustice, work for peace. He says, oh, I'm just testing. God says, me too. You know, I want us to take a kind of, a kind of mix of serious and enjoyable. Here's Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of the survivors of the concentration camps. Well, one of the writers during that era, a minister who talks about the pain they went through and says how it was a spirit. He writes this wonderful book about the spiritual experience of being in the world of genocide and what a rich perspective that gave him of his life. And so I want to see if we can kind of take that perspective ourselves. Not the big view from above when we're in our 747s heading to Europe for the summer, or in our C-130s heading over to Iraq, but down from the trenches, in the trenches, in the grassroots, in the wards. This is one of our wards. This is a large ward of the church in Nairobi, Kenya, that lives in this modern concentration camp. And I've been to that ward, and those are wonderful saints, and they struggle every day to try to stay alive. 83% of that ward is unemployed. Half of them have never really had any job at all. And we went through and surveyed all the wards in Nairobi and found those numbers were pretty much across the board. Martin Luther King says, because of the world we've created, we're going to have to repent of that somehow. We may have to repent of that somehow. Of course, to repent means we've got to be aware of the problems. A few months ago, I got this email from one of my former students who now works for the UN. And, it's too wide here, I can see that. He says, I got back from Somali last Friday. It was great to finally, after 20 years, go back to my home. And then he reports on this survey by the UN catering to the poor. They sent this email question out, would you please give your honest opinion about solutions to food shortage in the rest of the world? In Africa, they didn't know what food was. In Western Europe, they did not know what a shortage was. In Eastern Europe, they did not know what opinion meant. Middle East, they didn't know what solution meant. Thank you. South America, they didn't know what please meant. In Asia, they didn't know what honest meant. In the United States, they did not know what the rest of the world was. And I thought, you know, he was the first East African to go to BYU. Great young man. But he comes from a part of the world where this is the norm, where Gandhi declared the worst form of poverty, the worst form of violence was poverty. And this young man from Somalia came to BYU, stayed true to his faith, lived BYU's code of honor better than most of us Mormons. He's Muslim. But he's then dedicated the rest of his life to trying to solve these problems of poverty and trying to deal with how do you lift those who have so little that even can be lifted. So we're talking about a world today with huge amounts of economic deprivation, and that's tied to these problems of health or lack of health and the disease that we're engulfed in, environmental decline, political conflicts, and the lack of education, the lack of opportunity to try to, you know, make oneself, the quality of one's life, a little better. The church, we basically got the same problems in the church as the rest of the world. In the States, about 90% of our members are self-reliant. That is, they have jobs, they have some access to health care, many of them have some kind of retirement, they have opportunities for education. About 10% lack that. But in Latin America, the ratios are roughly reversed. we only have about 10% of the saints there in that region of the globe that have decent educational opportunities, that have some prospects for a job, that have some possibilities for a future for themselves. And so it makes a tremendous amount of challenge for us as we think about how do we as Latter-day Saints really practice our religion? What do we do beyond Sunday? How do we live these teachings that promise a better quality of life? And we have these foundations with notions like, in our theology, notions that say the church that doesn't have the power to save its people in this world will never have the power to save them in the next. How can we live with that and implement such a way that it becomes real world? That's our big challenge today. How do we address this kind of problem? And of course, in Latin America, things are better off there among the saints than other parts of the world, much of Asia, where they're gathering in church tomorrow, and they'll have a song. They won't have a pianist. They won't have an organ. But they'll sing a couple hymns. They'll pass the sacrament. A couple people will bear testimonies. And then they'll spend part of, or maybe the rest of the whole meeting, just talking about who's got rice, who's got meat, who's got vegetables, who's got beans. And let's share all we've got so that we can get through this next week. Or in the Philippines, where you go in a sacrament meeting in the, I think it's the Makati Ward, and as you enter into the chapel, there's these huge barrels, and they have a program there which is this. If you come to church, you got to bring a handful of rice, and you put it in that barrel. And at the end of church, those funds are redistributed, not those funds, those the rice, the food, the cans of tuna, the bananas, whatever you can bring, whatever you can spare, redistributed to the members of the ward. Hopefully they'll be able to make it through the next few days. And if you go to other countries like Zimbabwe, you go to church there after sacrament meeting is over and they're having a little break before Priesthood and Relief Society or Sunday School, they go out on the front lawn and they play merry-go-round. And everybody puts a dollar. 20, 30 people will stand in a circle. They'll all put a dollar. Each put a dollar in the middle. It'll be gathered up and given to the poorest person in the circle so that they can get through the next week. And maybe they can even start a little job or something like that. Here's Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon. He says, "We stand by as children starved by the millions because we lack the will to eliminate hunger. We have found the will to develop missiles capable of flying over the polar cap and landing within a few hundred feet of their target. This is not innovation. It's a profound distortion of humanity's purpose on Earth." And we've got lots of admonitions within the throughout the teachings of the church about remembering the poor, the needy, the oppressed, and calls from everybody present, Hinckley included, when he was a young man, to serve others, to help those who struggle, to lift the burdens of little saints like these wonderful members of the church in Guatemala, who, you know, have seen over 100,000 of their countrymen assassinated in the last few years. And I think for many of us, the assumption was or is that, you know, sure, times were hard a few years ago, but this last decade, the 90s, we've seen so many more new millionaires around the globe and billionaires. Everything's getting better. But the sad fact is that, and then our bubble burst, but for many in the third world, their countries never did get better. And I think the latest UNDP, United Nations Development Program data, suggests that about 60 of those countries in the developing nations are much worse off now than they were 10 years ago. Much worse off. So what can we do? How can we deal with that? Brigham Young is right. Part of the problem is they don't have opportunities. It's because of lack of opportunity to develop their talents and abilities that's causing the problem. So I want to talk about today, with that context of huge numbers of hyper-poor, tens of thousands dying every day because their little bodies are too malnourished to ward off pneumonia or ward off a cold or now we've got SARS and more HIV, AIDS, and other extremely severe diseases. But for many, their systems are just too weak, and they can't make it. So I want to talk about and give us some kind of images of potentiality, what some Latter-day Saint folks are doing to practice the gospel, to integrate the spiritual teachings with the practical strategies, which we end up calling praxis. You know, can we praxis what we preach? Is that one way of describing it? And I want to talk about a couple people. The first one is this person on the right, Muhammad Yunus, a crazy economist who got his PhD in America and went back to Bangladesh in the 70s to try to help his people with his newfound PhD. He saw the text didn't work. He saw the theories didn't fit the reality. And that his country, with IMF help and World Bank assistance and a civil war, was just going right down the tubes. And so he threw out his textbook, went to the villages and started listening to the poor as they described why they couldn't survive. And this is a shot of him and Nurjahan Begum, who is the number three person in what's called the Grameen Bank of Bangladesh, that has now loaned out over $4 billion to extremely poor people in that country, mostly women. So I use this slide with my MBAs to say, if you want to become a big shot in a bank, start out as a woman oppressed in Bangladesh, illiterate, unable to feed your family, and get a microloan like Nurjahan did. And her life is totally transformed because of that. And she's now third top manager in the bank. That little program, those initiatives over the past couple of decades, have led now to some 2.2 million people receiving loans, 5 million family members benefiting from that. My numbers here are a little old, it looks like. 37,000 village economies now have access to capital, and this village bank has gone on to create lots of other businesses. And they make a small profit. The bank is owned by those 2.2 million poor women. They have seats on their board of directors. And many of them, like this woman, started out as a humble peasant with virtually no future. She now has over 10,000 chickens in her chicken coops. She has 46 people working for her, including her husband. She bought a Mercedes truck to haul this poultry to this other villages, and she's become extremely successful. When she started, she made 3 cents a day. Today she makes $500 a day. Pretty significant improvement for her, and she's created jobs for lots of her friends and neighbors and others. Basically, that woman, lives in a world that's the bottom part of this cake here, okay? She lives in what's what we call the informal economy. The formal economy, let's just look at that a second, is the one you and I are aware of. It's the official economy of the world. It's the economy that the World Bank pays attention to. It's the economy at Davos, Switzerland, World Economic Forum they focus on. And it's the economy where you and I have jobs, we get paychecks. We get paychecks even when we don't show up to work. I'm drawing on my huge BYU salary right now, even as we speak. And Jim is drawing on his law firm salary or his corporation salary. So it's the formal system. And we have government programs, we have Social Security programs, we have all this stuff that is part of that official GNP-based formal economy. Then we have, underneath it, this black market economy, it's sometimes called, or informal, or underground economy, which is bartering, which is service, which is, you know, when we go out of here tonight at 5 or 6 or whatever, we're going to see little tiendas, kiosks, little stores, little guys, street vendors. That's the technical term. Street vendors, tiendas, the technical tiendas. And those people are selling stuff. that they bought for a few cents and they're going to sell it for a buck. Or Maria has been working all day with her daughters and making these pupusas and they're going to sell them on the streets tonight or whatever. And that's this economy of microcredit, of getting small loans or somehow bootstrapping yourself and starting a little business like this guy in Dhaka, and or growing your little crop, or in this case it's a huge crop, and taking off with that and getting to town and selling it, getting it to my village and trading it. Okay? And that's where lots of the poor try to, where they struggle in trying to build some kind of a better life. And I want to just talk about and give you some ideas of groups you might want to get involved with. Beyond our LDS theology, beyond our sunstone intellectual debates, I'm saying, so what? Screw them. Was that on tape? I don't know. You know, what can we do beyond our theories and our concepts and our theological doctrines to use our testimonies, to use our faith, to use our gospel social teachings and make a little difference in the world? And I think one of the things, I don't know what happened with you guys here. I was in New York. What was it, Jim? They had a humanitarian conference in New York a week or two after 9/11. And there were a lot of very impressive people there. They came out saying, we don't know what we can do. We want to start doing something. Many said things like this. I knew there were all these problems. I knew Afghanistan was a problem. I'd heard about this Taliban stuff or whatever. But I felt powerless to do anything. And I think what we see with these little examples, some LDS related and some not, is we can get a sense that, hey, we can be empowered. We can make a difference. We can maybe not do everything, but we can at least do something. So this one, I want to start with this case here, this group here, Grameen Foundation USA. I'm starting with it because it's here in D.C. And it was started by three BYU students and a guy who had worked with Professor Yunus, the economist, in Bangladesh. And they came here and said, let's set up a nonprofit organization to apply these village banking, these microcredit, small loans. And the way microcredit works is if we were starting a village bank in Bangladesh today, or in New York, to Washington, D.C., or Arlington today, we would send out some flyers or somehow get the word out. You guys all show up. I'm coming here from the organization, and I tell you what microcredit is. It's a $100 loan to help you start a little business. And you're interested in it because you don't have a way to get a loan other than this. You can't go to a bank. You're too poor. You're illiterate. You're scared of banks. You know where banks, what banks are. They're institutions with money inside and guns outside. And you're scared to death. And if you went in and dared to go up to a teller or a loan officer and explain you wanted a $100 loan to buy some flour to make tortillas, they would just laugh and say, get out of here. We don't give small loans. When I started one project in the Philippines, I went to the Asian Development Bank and said, I'm from Utah in the U.S. We're starting an NGO, a non-governmental organization, nonprofit foundation, to fight poverty in the Philippines. Do you give out small loans to entrepreneurs? They said, oh, yes, that's our main interest. I said, I've got 100 people who need very small loans. What's the amount you could give them per person? They said, we start out at $5 million and go up from there. You know, I said, okay, I'm bringing my elders' quorum over, you know. And then he's saying, no, we don't do that. We could never make money on that. That's not relevant. They want to help entrepreneurs that are already very successful and very big, but they're smaller than General Motors. That's what they call a small loan. Okay? And so that's the sort of thing that the Grameen Foundation does. And they said this project in the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh has been working very well. It's staying in Bangladesh. Their goal is to lift 1 million women every couple of years up above the poverty line. So let's start a foundation in the States and try to do this in the Western Hemisphere. And let's translate documents and material we have into Spanish and Portuguese. And let's try this in San Antonio. And let's try it in Chicago. And so they've been doing that. And these students have worked with them. So if you're interested in small business, if you're interested in learning the kind of methodologies that can reap poverty and help people move from dependency to dignity, from no credit to microcredit, and then after they pay back, and we give you guys each $100 today to go start making your tortillas or buy cloth to sew your dress or your shirt you're going to sell on the streets or whatever, or you got a little contract with a department store down the road, then you're going to pay that loan back. And we're going to meet every week, and you're going to pay back $10 on that $100 loan plus a quarter, 25%, 25 cents interest every week. And once that is paid off, then we're going to give you $200 loans, and then $400. And within the next year, you'll be up to about $1,000 loan per person. And we know this will work because we have a 98-99% payback rate in all these cases, virtually all of them. So we know it works. We know the poor want a job. We know they want to become self-reliant. Eventually, they can move to a $5,000 loan that they're going to get from the Arlington National Bank down the street. And then they're graduated, and they're out of our program. That's the kind of stuff Grameen does. And we've got a number of wards and stakes participating in these loans now. They need money. They need business people to help train them. They need all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
How many countries is this?
This is in about 30 countries now. And I'm talking just Grameen Foundation projects. There's lots of other groups doing this. It's not a little deal. There are about 50 million people around the planet that have now at least had one of these small loans and paid them back. Okay, they're in over 100 countries. Grameen is just one approach, one methodology, giving out very small amounts of capital. Usually they start $50,000. They'll give to a group in the Navajo Reservation or in Panama. And that nonprofit group there will actually run the program, administer the loans, collect the loans, get the principal back plus the interest, and then double them and grow up from there. So you know, look in the phone book next week. Look up Grameen. Look at their website. Call them up. Go visit. Ask if you can get involved. Where they got projects? What might you be able to do to help them? Time Magazine ran a cover story 2 years or so ago on visionaries of the new millennium. One of them featured there was Muhammad Yunus. Time described guys like Muhammad Yunus with this radical idea of empowering the poor through small loans, not through handouts, but loans. It says, visionaries are possessed creatures, men and women in the thrall of belief so powerful they ignore everything else, even reason, to ensure that reality catches up with their dreams. For always behind the action, there is an idea, a passionate sense of what is eternal in human nature and of what is coming, but is as yet unseen just over the horizon. And I think Yunus is a guy who's got that kind of vision and who's made a huge difference. And now the church is involved in probably $5 to $10 million a year of our tithings, and our LDS charity donations are going to fund these kinds of projects with Finca, with Grameen Foundation USA, with Catalysis in Nicaragua, etc. And you've, I'm sure, heard the brethren talk about some of these projects over the years. Another group. This is a church member in upstate New York. Kevin Clausen, guy who had some business success, who had BYU degrees, who decided, you know, there's more to life than making my money, having my big house, having my three cars and my boat, and serving in my church callings. And so he had this little vision that said, we ought to do something to reach the children around the planet. We ought to be serving those beyond our own borders. And he started this foundation, Reach the Children. And it's a phenomenal organization working in about 6 countries currently, trying to strengthen families with education. They started with schools, with literacy. Then they moved into vocational programs, microenterprise. Now they got health care and a number of other things. And they're looking for donors. They're looking for Latter-day Saints that want to join them. They're looking for people with business skills who can share some ideas, who can give them kind of evaluate their programs, and they do a few hundred thousand dollars a year in places like Ghana, like Kenya, like Malawi, and so forth. I was struck this last year by the terrible and tragic experiences of Elizabeth Smart. And I, with lots of other Utahns, went out on the search, tried to find that little girl, wondered how anybody could do something so terrible. And, then rejoiced, like I'm sure you did, when she was finally found and brought back home. But I, after the couple of times I went out in the hunt, in the search, in the seeking, after I'd done that a couple of times, I began to think about all those little children, all these countries I've seen who are also abused, who are also have disappeared, who have also been lost to their families, future we don't know about. And so I'm hoping we can kind of think about those sorts of individuals as well as the Elizabeth Smarts and the considerable coverage that the Smart family received. And as every night as we give the Lord thanks that she was found, I hope we can pray for all the others and thank our Heavenly Father when they too may be found, and figure out ways we can find them economically, we can find them socially, we can find them and uplift them educationally. Another NGO is called Enterprise Mentors. It focuses on micro-entrepreneurs, first in the Philippines and then elsewhere. This was an interesting kind of organization that grew out of one of my BYU projects, one of my classes, where I had a couple students. Yeah, that's better. Had a couple students that I said, I've got some letters from the Philippines. Church leaders over there are struggling. We got all these members, about 300,000 in 30 years. The church had anticipated we'd have about 35,000 members after 30 years. Instead, we were 10 times that in growth. And they've got no future. And so we did some initial studies looking at the church. The church members in the Philippines, this was 1989, and the Philippine population. You see, about 60% of our members are in the urban areas. Well, that's because that's where we're sending missionaries, right? We're not out in the country yet. But you see, we're considerably more poor in terms of average family income. 38,000 pesos is about $2,000. So annual income for an LDS family is about $2,000. A year, a little more in the general population. But you see, our members are more poor. We have greater unemployment. We have less self-employment. And so we decided to start a little research project and move to action. And we, after interviewing a lot of church members and talking with some of the folks in Salt Lake and the area presidency in Manila, and going out to places like this, which is Smoky Mountain, where we have a branch of the church, around this huge dump. It's one of the world's biggest dumps. It's been burning for 20 years. And we got our priesthood kids out there, our young guys, trying to gather up, you know, the bottles. So they're recycling the glass. They're spending all day gathering up the cardboard. They're spending all day gathering up paper. They're gathering the plastic. They're gathering the aluminum cans. And then they're selling that, and that's how they're making a living, and they're not going to school. And I met church leaders, guys like these, of a stake over there, that were designing piggeries, you know, backyard swine fattening programs. And they were doing the analysis of what it would take, how much wood it would take, and how to build a little pig pen in every stake member's backyard. And that was the way they were going to improve their lives. And then they wrote Salt Lake and said, we need $20,000. And every week, Salt Lake was getting requests from bishops, from Relief Society presidencies, from stake presidencies, saying, we've prayed. It tells us to ask you for $10,000, for $20,000, for $50,000. We have no future. Our members can't even afford 3 cents to take a jeepney to church. Our bishops can't afford to go to church. And so as we began to learn about that stuff, we said, look, let's design a strategy. And this woman here is part of that strategy. Her name is Vilma de los Santos. And she was working in a factory sewing clothing, and every item she made, a skirt or a blouse or a shirt in a day, she'd get paid a quarter for that. And she heard about Enterprise Mentors as we started it up. We went to stakes. We made announcements. And we got different awards to give a Saturday free room in their chapel to hold a micro-enterprise training session. And the members would gather together, and we'd talk about these small loans and try to figure out who had what kind of jobs and what was their lives like and what, you know, blah, blah, blah. Out of that, we gave people like Vilma small loans, and her life began to change. She quit her job. She got a $100 loan, quit her job, bought a sewing machine, started sewing in her own house. In this case, it's a knitting machine, so she's making knit sweaters and dresses and stuff like that. And she would be able to sell them for $5 to a department store because we had a consultant go with her and negotiate a contract. And EMI started from that, people like Vilma. Last time I saw her, she had 11 people working for her. She had a factory. She bought new land, built a little factory on it. She had all these sewing machines. Many of the women in her ward worked on those sewing machines. She paid them each $1.50 per item rather than 25 cents. Their salaries increased by sixfold. And that little organization has continued to grow and expand throughout the Philippines, now in Mexico, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and Peru. And basically it's all focused on this microcredit stuff. It's helping guys like these members of the church set up a little printing shop here called Camora Editions. You know, I don't know if they got the copyright approvals on that, but that's the kind of folks we know are hardworking. We know they're righteous members of the church. We know they have hungry kids, and we know that a $100 loan, not only will it bless them, it'll bless the giver. And that little organization that started, you know, with a few students and myself, and BYU saying, by the way, you can't do this, it'll never work. Those loans aren't big enough. Students can't create jobs. And, of course, it's professors. You know they're worthless. You know, we got all that kind of feedback. One administrator, a vice president at BYU, said, it's outrageous to train these students to think they can go out and make a difference in the world. I sent him a note back with a quote I once heard about, and it was by Anonymous, so I'm safe on that. It's probably Robert Kirby, I don't know. But the note was, be outrageous, it's the only place that isn't crowded. And last year, this little Enterprise Mentors organization gave out $1.7 million in loans and blessed about 10,000 families to become more self-reliant. Now, BYU is finally doing a few things. Let me talk about a couple projects we're doing on campus. I got to give you two more examples besides that. But one of the things we're doing is creating a Center for Economic Self-Reliance in the Marriott School, the bastion of capitalism, in a right-wing institution to which I am the only radical who still gets a paycheck. They fired that didn't have tenure. But they finally began to get interested in this stuff. And, you know, along with our main priorities, which are things like creating a huge $60 million indoor practice field for our big, tough football boys so that in November and December, when they're trying to get ready for bowl games, they won't get cold. Their little rear ends will stay warm along with their shoulder pads. We finally got a donor who gave us $3 million to start this thing at the Marriott School, which will focus on, well, it kind of builds off what we've been doing. We've now had six conferences on microenterprise. We bring people from all over the world here to learn this methodology and then go back and practice it. We've had about 300 students go out and do internships and published a number of journals and articles and stuff like that. And that little center is going to become a vehicle, I believe, So if you don't want to give to Grameen Foundation USA and you don't want to give to the BYU football practice field, you could consider something else called the Center for Economic Self-Reliance, and it'll make a big impact in the world. And what I'm finding is everywhere I go are lots of members of the church saying, I like this stuff. It fits with my own notions about building Zion. It fits with my beliefs about empowering the poor. It helps me realize there's something besides golf in life. And it helps me understand what the spirit of love is all about that Joseph mentioned. This is a quick one. This started out of a Salt Lake stake called Big Cottonwood. And again, it was a couple of my MBA students who said in a class, we want to do a project. We've got a stake youth conference coming up. What could we do in Latin America? We talked about Peru. And one of them had done a mission in Peru. He knew Chosky was the ancient Inca word for messenger. And they started a little foundation. And their stake raised $170,000. And they started sending people down to Peru. And they now have a lot of village development programs going, literacy, education. They work in little villages way up in the Andes, 11,000 feet, like helping these indigenous people create a better quality of life, have education for their children, have some hope in a future. And these guys at Big Cottonwood Stake, they just took this verse in the scriptures literally and said, oh, we can do that. We can go out. We can make a difference. I'm thrilled, by the way, with lots of other programs that are going on that the church is sponsoring, and I certainly encourage you to all donate to those as well, whether it's helping the victims of the Bosnia or Kosovo situation, or it's helping volunteer some time at the employment center in your town, or maybe it's funding the Perpetual Education Fund in Brazil, where we now have thousands of return missionaries coming home every year with no future, no possibilities of school, no real job options because they don't have the education. And those folks are figuring out with a little bit of money that they can get in an electrician's training program, or they can get go to a carpentry or plumbing school, or they can have some, in a few cases, they're even using it for college, and their lives will be dramatically different. Another group is called Unitas. You may have heard about Unitas. There's about 10 of us that got involved in putting some resources together and saying, what could we do if beyond students and beyond wards and stakes, well, that's not even showing up, is it? We could create a fund to really help leverage the fight against poverty from private donations. And so we started this organization called Unitas, which literally means unite us. Last year we put $1.875 million into Mexico and started working with an NGO there that had just, well, they had zero jobs. They just started when we found them. We looked at all the organizations doing this microenterprise stuff in Mexico. We decided this had the most potential to grow very quickly into a significant player. Here they are a year later. They've created 3,000 jobs. We just got back from being down there to look at that situation. We're going to have 30,000 jobs there in the next couple of years. Likewise, we're doing a similar thing with SKS. That's a relatively small organization in India. It's called, SKS means Village of Self-Reliance. And they're focusing on people that don't earn 25 cents a day. They're focusing on people who only have an income per day of 10 to 15 cents. They've been there about 5 years. It's run by some U.S. Indians whose parents came from there, who felt a calling, a spiritual calling, to go back and help the poor in their country. And they've now created about a client base giving these micro loans out. They start at $50. Very small loans. They've got about 12,000 clients. They have 50,000 clients a few years from now. Well, there's lots of other possibilities. I'm out of time. I'm finding there's things that we can each do as housewives, as students, as scholars, as business people, as lawyers, as unemployed church members, as parents, as grandparents. We can talk about this stuff. We can learn about it. You can get on the web and find out what's going on. Here's a group of students that created the Little Village Bank in a Catholic community. These are BYU kids working with an organization called Help International. That little group started out their first year. These are just students who raised, we thought we'd get about 10 or 15 students and raise about $10,000 after Hurricane Mitch destroyed Honduras. We thought we'll just try to get a few students and go down and see what we can do. We ended up with a huge group, 46 students. We raised $116,000. We started 47 new village banks, including this one by these wonderful Catholic sisters who named their bank Going Down the Road in the Hand of Jesus Bank. Bigger than Zion's Bank one of these days. I find many people giving of their lifestyle, giving of their time. They're going out and finding books on this stuff. They're reading about it. And then they're starting to talk to their friends. I have neighbors who say, no more Christmases. We're not doing the commercialism anymore. We're going to pool our resources that we would normally give out in presents that don't, none of us need, that don't really mean anything. They break after, the kids' toys break, whatever. And we're just going to, we're going to put that together and we're going to fund a bank. Or we're going to give money to Chosky's Literacy Program. Or the group that works in Walesabugu in Muslim West Africa, in Mali. Tremendous poverty. And families are just saying, we're giving our 1,000 for this year. We're giving our 700 we'd normally spend ourselves. So talking to others, learning from others, giving a little bit, going on an expedition, funding somebody else to go do an internship. Right now we've got about 50 students from the Y and from Harvard and from Stanford and Colorado State and the U of U and hopefully from Columbia and Georgetown and other places in the future. I was just back at Harvard. We're creating a partnership with them to create a database of all these kinds of opportunities individuals have in the United States to go out and spend 2 months or 6 weeks or 4 months or just a week's expedition and get in the trenches with the poor and in the process learn a great deal about the meaning of life and the power that each of us has to make a difference. I hope you'll be interested in this. Join in the cause. Find out what's out there. I've left some flyers and stuff from programs I'm involved with. If you want to email me, if you want to look at some websites, I've got a list of different organizations that are doing this, some of which are affiliated with the church or with BYU, and others are totally independent. We're all independent, I guess. More of an arm's length relationship. There's a great deal we can all do. I hope you'll join me in the cause. Thanks very much. Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot. Millions and millions. I think they've given out about $10 million to some of these groups doing microloans in the last several, four or 5 years. Are they ignoring the Utah poor?
Yes.
Meaning what?
Meaning the downwinders.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything. I know they've given out tons of money. I'm talking tens of millions to poverty programs in Utah in the last 5 years. Tens of millions. Are they funding everything that needs it in Utah? I don't think so. Are they doing everything you or I might like them to do? I don't know.
I think this is extremely complicated.
I don't know what to tell you on that. Does anybody have a good date on that? They created this inner city mission, right? And that was that took about 10 years of debate. They tried so many things that didn't work in Salt Lake. Salt Lake. I'm not talking downwinders now. I'm talking, right around the valley there. They finally said, if we take these scriptures seriously, every man according to his needs and wants, we ought to look at another model. And this was Elder Morrison when he was area president like 7 or 8 years ago. Looked at those scriptures, debated a lot, prayed, discussed, and they finally created this program. They have about 400 folks doing inner city missions and they're basically going to the homes of the poor. That's the Tongans, the Vietnamese, the Latinos, the African Americans in Salt Lake Valley, and they're saying, "What do you want?" And then they're giving it to them. They're not saying, "What we think you need." They're not saying, "According to our program, these are the 10 steps you ought to take." They're saying, "Tell us what you want. We're going to give it to you." And it's a pretty phenomenal program. It's costing multi-millions to run that. And that's just one, you know, fairly recent thing. They're not solving all the problems, though, that's for sure. Other comments? Other reactions? Yeah.
I have a question.
Here.
Since it appears that
a wise choice. Yeah, it's a great choice. I always tell people you should give the church first. I think that's what I understand the scriptures, but not just to the church. And I don't hear Salt Lake saying, "Give us all your money." They want us doing many good things of our own free will. But I know a lot of people, that's the first thing to give because, A, it's a commandment. B, they trust the system. They know that it's going to be, you know, that those funds aren't going to be going to some overhead in Kenya or some overhead in Washington, D.C. or whatever. All those funds are put right through. The overhead is funded by the church businesses and the tithing funds. So no salaries are coming from this sort of work. And it's expensive to set up these employment centers, to set up these nonprofit programs, to do this literacy stuff, do all the health care they're funding around the globe. And so I think you're going to get a big bang from the bucks you give there. But I also know lots of Latter-day Saints who say, you know, there's sort of this going up steps, okay? So I give what's required, what the scriptures say we're commanded to give. You know, I want to get involved in some way. What can I do? Well, you know, I can write a check to the NGO down the street, or I can help fund that ward. I'm thinking of whole wards that have basically, Pace and Stake, for instance, they basically gathered up all the extra resources and products they had in their stake, and a guy who drove a school bus has been making trips to El Salvador for 3 summers, just with a school bus loaded of stuff, drove to El Salvador and back for 3 summers now, just taking down all this clothing and food. People just took food out of their kitchens and bedding and medicines, and companies gave hammers and saws and stuff like that to help people rebuild after the quake. It's basically, impacted 70% of all the structures in El Salvador. And the stake's saying, yeah, the Red Cross is going to do its thing. The LDS Church is going to give some big bucks, you know, and the UN is going to do something. But say, we want to get involved. Now they've got stake members going down and distributing this stuff. I'm thinking of people like Carol Gray in the UK, who's watching the Bosnia disaster. She's a Relief Society president in Mansfield. Is that right? England. And she says, I prayed every night. And the Lord kept saying, you need to do something as Relief Society president for the people in Bosnia. She went to her bishop. He said, that can't be a revelation. The Bosnians will get that, you know. They're not in our ward. You heard that? You heard that, right? She said, I think we should do something. So she asked the members to donate stuff, said, we'll take it in our car, we'll drive to Bosnia. Through the channel, you know. And they got so much stuff. After the first week, she said to her husband, I think the Lord wants us to sell our car and buy a big truck. So they sold their car and bought a big truck. Then she said, I think we need more stuff. Let's advertise in other churches. They went to other churches. Pretty soon, she said, I think she said, after a month, they would get so many donations every week put on the porch of the chapel, you know, they'd have to send the priesthood in early to move all the donations aside so they'd get the doors open and go to church. And then they spent the Relief Society period, I don't know about the priesthood, they were probably in there presiding in their meeting, but the Relief Society was sorting and boxing all this stuff. And she's now done 20 convoys of 10 or 15 trucks, huge trucks. She's been shot at. She's been forced to pay bribes, etc. Pothole trucks, breakdown trucks, guys trying to steal their stuff. She just keeps doing this stuff. That's a whole different level than writing a check the LDS Humanitarian Service or LDS Charities. And, you know, then others are doing these kits, and they're making the gauze bandages for the lepers, and they're making the school kits. And folks like the Chosky people that started Big Cottonwood, you know, they now get 5,000 kits. They never ask for kits, but groups do it and bring them to them. Medical kits, newborn kits, education kits, kids that then down in those countries get a package with paper, pencil, pen, scissors, tape, you know, all the critical things you need for school that we get without even thinking about it here. They don't. That's a month's salary for their dads. So people are doing different things. But then I think for many, they've donated, they've gone on an expedition, they've funded a student to be an intern, they've you know, driven to Bosnia or El Salvador or whatever. Then there's sort of another level which people can say, you know, we ought to do something on our own. We ought to, well, I don't know, let's get together, let's talk about it. And so these guys, they get together and they start reading and they're talking about that great Jim Lucas book, Working Toward Zion, and they start finding, they get on the website and they start seeing, right, Jim? It's a great book, right? That's right. Jim will sign it. He's legible. Only lawyer that's legible. And they talk and they create these book clubs and they start getting a vision of what they might do and they brainstorm and some of them say, you know, we were in Brazil 20 years ago. We baptized 500 people on our missions, blah, blah, blah. Wouldn't it be great to go back and see those people? Let's go down, see what's happening. And then they come back to the States and they tell their ward, you know, that country, those members, that ward, that stake, they're no better off now than they were then. And I'm a millionaire. And I'm sitting here in Baltimore, whatever, you know. And I got too much money. I don't want to just give it to my kids. I don't want to just give it to the BYU football program or the U's football program. And so they start their own little NGOs. And they try stuff out. And they see where. So I'm talking to a bunch of guys, for instance, in Arizona. Read about some of this stuff. Said, this next Christmas, let's just take our three families and let's go down and try to help reopen a school on the Caribbean coast of Central America that we read about in the U.S. News and World Report was just devastated. Let's go down and help rebuild it. Let's get some guys to come with us who have building skills, engineering skills, construction skills. They went and did it. Next year, 40 people went. The next year, 100 people went from Phoenix and Mesa, Arizona. And now other groups have sprung off from that in other parts of Arizona. And who am I thinking? Wendy Peterson, I think is her name. She and her husband said, you know, we ought to go down. Let's quit our jobs here in Utah County. This is Springville. Let's quit our jobs in Big Springville and move down there and run that school and set it up and train young people who could be teachers in the school. So they quit their jobs, took their five kids and moved down. Or Steve, who am I thinking? Steve Mann, OD consultant and management trainer. He just takes off to Zimbabwe to fight HIV/AIDS. He's not a doctor. And he spent 3 years of his life living over there. And then he was recognized, that program called Raising the Generation was recognized by the UN as the best anti-AIDS program in the world, in Africa. I don't know about the world, in Africa. He didn't know anything. He couldn't even spell HIV. No, he could spell. I'm just saying, so there's sort of these different levels and different stages of life when we can go and do something. Final comment, question, observation? Yeah, Bonner.
Just to extend the story.
It really has to be a partnership. And part of the goal I have with all these groups and projects I work with and advise and consult with and help start and then they spin off is that, you know, you cannot ride in on your big white horse as the savior. You've got to find groups there that are already organized. That's the best way to leverage what you want to do for good, is find somebody who's already taken some initiative, who already has something going. And I'm shocked and amazed at the number of LDS folks in the third world, for instance, that are doing their own things, like these handful of rice programs in the Philippines or the merry-go-rounds in Africa and stuff, you know. You don't want to just show up with a bunch of stuff and say, now where can we hand this out and have them take our pictures with them, and we take their picture and go back home, yeah. You need to have somebody who's sophisticated enough to be organized, to have taken some initiative, someone that shares a lot of the goals you do, you know, which is we want to become self-empowered, become sustainable. We want to have an organization that's going to bless many a little rather than just a couple of us and make us rich like you and stuff like that. And so it's kind of figuring out those partnerships, pre-trip communications, and often it really means you got to go there first, somebody does, and meet with them and assess, do a little audit, figure out, is this organization trustworthy? If we give them money, is it going to go to the project, to the babies, or is it going to go to the leaders and their board? And so it's kind of doing some homework. There's a group, I think it's on one of the handouts, called Action Against Poverty, which we started, again, Honduras, another program, starting village banks. We got, these were students that wanted to just start their own banks. Some were partnered with other groups that had experience. These kids said, we want to start our own. They got 100% payback on that stuff. But eventually, that evolved from Acción Contra la Pobreza in Honduras to Action Against Poverty, which is a network of when we started, we had about 40 or 50 LDS-related nonprofit groups doing this stuff. And they needed help with, how do you form a board? How do you start a program in a country? How do you determine which group to give it to? What's the criteria for you raising money to help them or giving them clothing or food or whatever? And within a year or so, we found there were about 100 nonprofit groups. Now we figure there's about 300 LDS nonprofit groups, mostly in the U.S., a few in Europe. Cecile Pelouse with her orphanage in Nepal, French Relief Society president, going off the deep end, helping little kids, you know, helping them become in control of their own futures. So Action Against Poverty would be a good source to talk with about who do they know in this country. They're going to end up having some kind of, not quite like, you know, Chamber of Commerce stamp of approval, but something like that in terms of saying, we've looked at their books, we know this organization, we've seen how they work, and they're not condescending, or we've seen how they work, and they're empowering. And so that would be a good source. You could email Action Against Poverty or go to one of their conferences and stuff like that. Yeah. Right. Right. You can't. Yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch of them, and they're on some of those handouts. And just check the websites. They got the frequently asked questions. They got best practices. They got known entities. In a few cases, they've got questionable entities, and go from there. Final comment. Are we good for one more?
Is there a list of the LDS?
There's about 120 or so on this website of Action Against Poverty, and from there you can find others. Well, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Hope we can all do something.